Welcome to the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. Today, efforts are underway in New York City to make the subways safer.
That enforcement commitment is a game changer.
The head of the Berry Street Alliance is strongly opposed to a move to make permanent those outdoor dining structures that kept restaurants going during the pandemic. I'll chat with Shannon Phipps.
It's not that just the sheds being a hazardous condition is something we're contesting. Our issue is that the city did not do an environmental impact study.
We'll hear from Newark Mayor Raz Baraka about why the city's lead replacement effort is being praised at the federal level.
For decades, the country has been relying on corrosion control to coat the pipes to keep lead out of the water.
And our film critic Harlan Jacobson reviews The Automat.
New York City historian Lisa Keller recalls the Automat phenomenon as quintessentially American.
All this coming up today on the WBGO Journal. New York City officials are unveiling a plan to make the subway system safer. The plan expands response teams. Clinicians will now be added to those teams that also include the NYPD and community groups to help connect the homeless with services. NYPD Commissioner Keyshawn Sewell.
The subway will be safe, and the people who use it have to be protected. And the conditions that cause fear must be ameliorated.
Meanwhile, MTA Chair John Oliber says another key part of the plan is NYPD officers are now being instructed to enforce subway rules.
No more open drug use, no more smoking, no more oversized shopping carts. That enforcement commitment is a game changer. Making sure that we have a safe system is key to winning riders back.
People will also now be required to get off trains at the end of subway lines. The plan is geared toward helping the homeless and addressing a huge spike in transit crime to start off the year. A vote by the New York City Council is expected next week on a proposal to make permanent the outdoor dining structures that were created to keep restaurants going during the pandemic. Several neighborhood groups are not happy about it, including Shannon Phipps of the Berry Street Alliance and a member of the Queue Up Coalition. I had a chance to speak with her earlier this week. Well, we know that the city council is looking into this, and, you know, no one's really arguing that the restaurants and workers suffered considerably with lost wages and revenues during the COVID shutdown when indoor dining was not allowed. So that's not what you're fighting. What you're fighting is the so-called sheds that are still up now after the main part of the pandemic is over. And some of those aren't even being used, I understand. Tell us why the Berry Street Alliance is so upset about these sheds and the possibility that they could stay open to allow restaurants to have outdoor dining.
Well, the sheds, as we know, are hazardous, and they've become sites of hazards in our neighborhood. We are also working with Queue Up New York City, and they have it even worse than we do because they're in Manhattan. These sheds have been sites where rodents like to make nests. They get into the planters. They have a normal stream of food to eat. They have water because of the standing water. When the diners leave, they crawl all over the tables and the chairs. We've seen them spread from the sheds to the burrowing in the tree pits. The backyards in this area are infested with rats, which has never happened before. We see them everywhere now, even in the cars. That's always, you know, that's a city thing. They get into cars, especially in the winter, but it's even worse now. We also have a lepto outbreak in Brooklyn at our dog park. And while we can't affirm scientifically that it's from the sheds, there seems to be a correlation with the presence of sheds and the rise in the population of rats. And I would also like to just mention that it's not that just the sheds being a hazardous condition is something we're contesting. Our issue is that the city did not do an environmental impact study, and that is required by law. If you're going to make city changes at this level, you have to do an environmental impact study, and that's a part of the ULURP land use laws, and that this is a land use issue, a zoning issue, and the impact study was triggered as soon as that became something on the table, as in we want to make this now permanent beyond the temporary executive order that was initiated by the mayor.
I'm curious what kind of conversations, if any, you've had with restaurant owners saying, hey, look, you know, we understand why you have these and during the heightened aspect of COVID, but now they're causing a nuisance and they're causing health issues. Have you had any conversations with any restaurant owners?
I personally have not had conversations with the restaurant owners. Members of Berry Street Alliance have, and they have not gone well. Residents have had to have undesirable conversations with restaurant owners about the crowds, the cigarette smoking, the noise, the amplified music. I would say 95%, if not 98% of the restaurants here are violating the guidelines that were presented by the DOT. So neighbors have had to go to restaurants and ask them to not amplify music. You can see this all throughout the district in Greenpoint and in Waynesburg, where restaurants have hardwired speakers outside of their restaurants and they have it blasting music. Where it becomes a cacophony of hell is when you have two restaurants next to each other doing the same thing. Unfortunately, restaurateurs have this bold attitude that they're allowed to do whatever they want. And quite frankly, they are, because the DOT hasn't enforced anything. And the DOT actually admitted at the public hearing provided by the New York City Council last week, they admitted that they have not been enforcing and that they have been lax on the restaurants.
What was the atmosphere like at the hearing? Were you there?
I was. It was 10 hours, and it was basically the Department of City Planning and the DOT doing the same thing that they've been doing for the last year, which is using their taglines, saved 100,000 jobs, vitalizing the city, envisioning landscape. This was the lifeline. They were just giving us the same song and dance. They have still not come up with a solution to many of the problems that have been pointed out to them. They still don't know what they're doing.
We're speaking with Shannon Phipps, who is a member of the QUP Coalition. She is also the head of the Berry Street Alliance. And when it comes to the issues that you're facing, is it frustrating to the fact that this program was started under Mayor Bill de Blasio and now there's a new mayor, Eric Adams, who is going to be keeping this program alive if the council approves it?
It is frustrating because Bill de Blasio did not seem to be about quality. He seemed to be all about quantity as he was leaving office. We also had a bunch of New York City Council members come into office that weren't serving in 2021. And they did not adequately debate this issue. There has been this feeling by the community that this is a done deal, that deals have been made, decisions have been made, and we're all the last to know about it. But this is permanent. Even though we're still in the process, it feels as if we're just being entertained with these conversations going nowhere, because it's just getting pushed to the next step in the process without residents being addressed, without community concerns being enforced or made into law.
Is there, in your mind, a compromise of some sort that both sides could say, yeah, I can see their point?
Well, I feel like the whole making an executive order, which is a temporary program, into a permanent program was a very dictator move, especially in the fact that community boards were sideswiped with the time limits. Most community boards were on summer break when they were supposed to be voting on this. I've reviewed a lot of community board meetings. Most people don't know what they're voting on. Listen, zoning and land use, it's very complicated. And it's not something that a normal layperson is going to be well-versed on. But I think the New York City Hospitality Alliance, which is a branch of the National Hospitality Coalition, is the second biggest lobby in our nation. So That's how much power, that's how much money and funding they have. They have ensured throughout the COVID period that the top franchises have profited from this, or, you know, at the expense of their employees. By the way, none of this money that was used to help the restaurants was earmarked for payroll for workers. Their wages did not rise. Their health benefits did not rise. They had an opportunity to negotiate those terms, and they flat out said no. But now they want New York City to give them all this land. I don't feel there is a compromise, because what they've done is undemocratic. And they have given present day, being the DOT and the Department of City Planning, have given presentation after presentation and have excluded the word resident. They have excluded the word that is so important to, is the heart of all communities. It's the people that live here, the people that are rooted here, the people raising their families here, that need to sleep here, that work here, that were not mentioned anywhere in their presentations. And in fact, in the new diagram they propose, they have failed to list that above the planters, the outdoor dining, above all that, people live. The Department of City Planning shows you a map and they say, see all the green? These are the residential areas. See the blue? This is where open dining could happen. That disingenuous presentation leaves out the fact that in the blue, people live. Most people live in mixed zones. There is no compromise in a mixed zone. We are in the compromise. The compromise already exists. So for them to act like we need to compromise more is a false presentation of reality, quite frankly.
Shannon, can you talk about the development of the Berry Street Alliance? How did that happen?
We came out of the pandemic because of an open street that was created on Berry Street, and it was done behind closed doors, the same as open restaurants, in a non-transparent process. And we, again, supported the open street in the beginning because it got people out of their house and it seemed to be a positive thing for the community. But like open restaurants, it went from an executive order, a temporary purpose, to a permanent fixture. And like the open restaurants, the open streets are hazardous, except instead of sheds, we're dealing with barricades. And we're dealing with 1.1 miles of a barricade. And like the open restaurants, the open streets did not go through the proper process. In other words, there was no environmental impact study done. So we have diverted traffic. We had our street turned into a block party. There were people that came here and party till 4 a.m. I've never seen so many men urinate. They did it on our door. They did it in broad daylight between the cars all day. We have elderly disabled people that live here. They can't move the barricades. They can't access their home. A lot of quality of life issues. And so Berry Street Alliance formed in response to that, because we weren't able to get any of our concerns addressed through the DOT or any of the partner programs, which were related to the Transportation Alternatives Lobby. And they, like the New York City Hospitality Alliance, are working in many states, are very well organized and very well funded, and seem to have the exclusive ear of our politicians.
The groups recently had a rally earlier this month to talk about this issue, to raise awareness. Did you find that that rally was successful for you, because things seem to still be moving against you?
Yes. Well, it's a big battle going against a machine that's well-funded and well-organized and has seemingly already made a deal. But I believe the rally was very important and very successful, because I feel that it has spread a lot of awareness. I think that most people don't know what's going on or why it's going on. I think most people keep reading the same stories from the same big media outlets, and they keep seeing the same buzzwords. Unbeknownst to them, that's the propaganda. Lifeline, revitalization, without giving it a second thought. What does that really mean? And if you aren't living with it, or you're not subjected to these conditions on a daily basis, you can buy into the fantasy. And that is what the Department of City Planning and the Department of Transportation is selling you, a fantasy.
Shannon Phipps, who is the head of the organization Berry Street Alliance. She's also a member of QUIP Coalition. Thanks so much for joining us on the WBGO Journal.
Thanks, Doug.
You're listening to the WBGO Journal. If you enjoy this program that airs every Saturday morning at 6:30 right here on WBGO, we're asking you to take a moment and support the news programming that you hear on the world's greatest jazz station, WBGO. You can call us at 1-800-499-9246. It's just as easy to go online and make a pledge of financial support from anywhere in the world at WBGO.org. On our latest edition of WBGO's call-in program, Newark Today, Mayor Raz Baraka spoke to host Michael Hill about why he's so proud that Vice President Kamala Harris came to Newark to praise the city's lead replacement program.
Mr. Mayor, I want to talk about Vice President Kamala Harris, someone who is an alumnus of Howard University, just like you. She was in town last week talking about the progress Newark has made in the lead service line replacement in the city of Newark. Why did she come?
Well, we were glad that she did. I mean, I know that the administration is going around pushing the infrastructure package that they set up. And for the most part, really talking about the importance of removing lead service lines all over the country and the money that they've put out front to help make that happen. And in Newark, we basically completed all of our tasks in terms of removing the lead service lines that we know of in the city. And we did it in less than 3 years.
Can that be what Newark has done? Can it be replicated someplace else?
Sure. I think now that all of this money is being made available by the federal government, by the administration, people have the opportunity to do this. Obviously, it's going to take a collaborative effort between the state, county, and municipal governments to make these things happen. There's specific laws that need to be passed, and there's constant communication that needs to go on between the residents and the municipality in question. So it's definitely possible to do. It's a heavy lift, but it's not something that's out of people's reach.
And it's a must, is it not?
It's absolutely a must. I mean, for decades, the country has been relying on corrosion control to coat the pipes, to keep lead out of the water. Countless times, again, it's been proven it's not foolproof, it's not working completely and totally. And the best way to get rid of that is by removing the lead service lines, which are illegal anyway at this point.
What role would you say citizen activism has played in the city of Newark to get the city where it is today?
Well, I mean, most of the activists have always been involved in pushing clean water action here in the city of Newark. ICC, the Newark Environmental Commission, all these folks have been partners with us in making sure all of the time in identifying issues around water and making sure we found grants and pushing us to communicate better with the residents, having opportunities for us to talk to our federal and state partners. You know, so they've been incredibly instrumental in helping us get forward to where we are today.
If a mayor or a governor called Raz Baraka, the mayor of Newark, and said, "Hey, we got this big issue with these lead service lines. What is step one?" What do you say to them?
Oh, they need the capital. That's step one. If you don't have the capital, you can't do it. It's just a dream. They told us it would take 10 years to get it done with what they were trying to do for us here. We had to find the capital. And that was the first thing we needed to do, find capital so we could change the lead service lines. Then you have to pass legislation that would allow you to change lead service lines that are on people's private property. Those are the two major things that have to be done, hurdles right away.
So at this point, are people no longer using filters, no longer have to rely on bottled water? They can just drink the tap in Newark?
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, obviously there's a protocol to follow once your lead service line has been changed. I think there's like a 30-day period for your line to be flushed and for us to come back out and test it. But other than that, you know, the exceedances should be very low to none. I mean, the last one I checked, my water, we were at like 0.2%. So we were almost negligible.
So is the Baraka family now drinking? You're drinking the tap water? If so, for how long?
We definitely cooking with our tap water again and all those other things. Absolutely.
Mayor Baraka also talked about legislation in the Garden State to establish a reparations task force. This historic measure would require New Jersey to study and take responsibility for its role in American slavery and to make policy recommendations to repair its enduring effects. The mayor says he's very concerned about what's going on in schools across the nation.
Laws that are being passed or being opposed that are stopping us from getting voting rights or expanding our voting rights, or even teaching Martin Luther King in school. I mean, there are local legislatures that are passing laws saying if white kids feel uncomfortable in class, that teachers could be sanctioned. I mean, this is a move to go backwards, not forward. And so more than ever, we need to be raising a flag and a banner on these things.
In terms of reparations, what would you like to see? And let me take a step back. The legislature, as I said, in New Jersey, has had this legislation for quite some time. But as far as we know, no hearing has been scheduled on this legislation.
Right, right. And that legislation, you know, is important. They have decided that they want to talk about the wealth gap and they want to study the wealth gap. But the wealth gap was created, began because of slavery and all the issues that emanated from slavery is why the wealth gap exists. So we need to go a step further and begin to analyze and study this. And what we should do should be based on a real calculated analysis and study of the severity of the problems that exist as a result of that and how we begin to repair those, whether it's opportunity for education, whether it's opportunity for direct funding. We don't know. We have to really get into this and have a real discussion about it.
How do you read what's taking place in the legislature? I guess what I should say is hasn't taken place. Do you read this as if there's not a will to do this? There's not a will to hear this legislation, to hear a debate on it, a will not to even study the issue?
Well, I think really it's the people. We have to be organized and make enough noise, the same noise that people are making around the country to stop people from reading Maya Angelou, to stop people from reading Toni Morrison, that are banning the bluest eye and telling you can't read Martin Luther King speeches, that are forcing boards of education around the country to reverse one teacher want to teach about Black history. They got to send a letter out to parents and saying you can opt out if you want to. I mean, this stuff is ridiculous, and that's because they're organized and they're pushing. And we have to do the same thing on our side to create an environment where it's uncomfortable for the legislature not to do it.
I know that Lieutenant Governor Sheila Oliver is in support of this legislation, but higher than that, the governor. Is there any indication that the governor's on board, from your perspective, the governor's on board with this?
The rhetoric and the things that he says is in line with this. He has been progressive thus far. As we talk about the wealth gap, he's been on top of the wealth gap. I think that he just needs to take it one step further and go beyond the wealth that gap and get right to reparations, because that's what needs to be talked about.
If you missed this edition of Newark Today, you can check out all of the shows by going to the WBGO and Newark Today Facebook pages. Lisa Hurwitz's The Automat, which came out of the Telluride Film Festival and opens this week at the Film Forum in Manhattan, is a seductive dive back through time into the Art Deco origins of the horn and hard art automats. You may remember those magnificent walls of little glass door cubbies full of mac and cheese, cream spinach, lemon meringue, or chocolate coconut cream pies, store-cooked ham sandwiches on rye, and Salisbury steak. That, for the price of a few nickels scraped together, fed New Yorkers and Philadelphians for the first 60 years of the 20th century. Our film critic, Harlan Jacobson, takes the nickel ride.
First-time director Hurwitz and writer-editor Michael Levine, whose editing chops in the past include some excellent doc work on Restrepo, The Central Park Five, and Bobby Fischer Against the World, together trace the rise of horn and hard arts automats from their origin in 1988 in Philadelphia through its ignominious end in 1991 in New York City. Philadelphian Joe Horn took an ad looking for a partner and turned up New Orleans French press coffee maven Frank Hardart and opened up their first venture on South 13th Street in Philadelphia before expanding to the next logical place, New York City. They fashioned dolphin head spouts seen on a trip to Italy to dispense coffee for a nickel. I've paid $35 for a cup of coffee that wasn't as good, says Mel Brooks, the film's unofficial godfather, and late in the film, its official crooner.
Some people just adore martinis. others love iced tea. In Venice, they all go for Bellinis. But coffee, that's for me. I've tasted every kind of brew at every coffee shop. Some were good and some were great, but this one was the top. There was nothing like the coffee at the Automat. Its aroma and its flavor were supreme.
Part of the film's charm is simply the archival river of simple but elegant, well-lighted Art Deco marble and brass palaces that slide by in black and white, beneath outdoor signage that has been colorized here in red and gold to stand out. Automats caught the rise of the American city and the flood of women and immigrants into the workforce before white flight to the suburbs. New York City historian Lisa Keller recalls the Automat phenomenon as quintessentially American. Having no baggage of discrimination, they were simply public restaurants where immigrants didn't need English and no one had to figure out how much to tip. Joe Horn's business model was benevolent, non-union paternalism, and the seeming impersonality of the wall of magical windows full of treats gave people space to replenish at a price they could afford. Besides the descendants of Joe Horn and Frank Hardart, as well as of the engineers and architects who captured the optimism of the early 20th century in the Automat's design, Hurwitz's witnesses gathered over 8 years of production are New Yorkers we like, a cavalcade of recently deceased whom Hurwitz improbably captured on film. Ruth Bader Ginsburg remembers doing her homework on the second floor after school, and the Automat served everyone, she said. Colin Powell recalls the Automat as nothing like this little Jamaican boy had ever seen before, and that when he was struggling to complete the integrated army, he drew on his memory of the dining rooms of the Automat. Ex-Philly Mayor Wilson Good recalls the Automat as a meeting place for 60s civil rights activists in Philly. Starbucks big mocker Howard Schultz wants you to connect the dots between the Automat's let's sit around and laissez-faire over coffee and his own shops, reciting some very good corporate scriptwriter's words and holding up a show-and-tell picture of the Automat's cubicles that he keeps in his office. Memorable is the 1964 candid camera sequence of Alan Funt's victims putting a nickel into the slot for a hard roll, followed by a hand darting out to snatch the roll back and slam the cubby door shut. Elliot Gould remembers the Automat's Sunday morning children's hour TV show and all the famous showbiz folk that floated through, from James Dean to Arnold Stang, Eddie Fisher, Jack Benny, and Rosemary Clooney, and the ongoing shtick between Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner. Now Brooks is a benevolent rogue elephant on camera wherever he goes, here breaking through the rectangular cubby that is also the fourth wall of the camera lens in the first minutes to ask Hurwitz, "What possessed you? You're about 11 years old to make a picture about the Automat." And Hurwitz isn't even from New York. She's from L.A. But she lets Brooks break through the glass lens in the film's 79 rather short entertaining minutes as she and Levine and the wonderful archives they pillaged make a convincing case for the Automat as the witting private enterprise that served the high and the mighty, the low and the humble, equally, and let them all catch a bite and a breath. We sign off with Brooks performing the Automat song he wrote with his collaborator-composer Hummy Mann and sings in front of a stringed orchestra. The song's no banana cream pie, but, you know, it's good to be the king. And I'm Harlan Jacobson.
And for just a shiny nickel, your taste buds you could tickle with that wonderful, magnificent, unbelievable, awesome coffee at the Automat. Use everything I've said. I'm popular. I'm famous. Make me the spearhead of selling this Meshuggah documentary.
Thanks for listening to the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. If you enjoy the news programming like the WBGO Journal, we ask that you take a moment right now and support this great radio station, your public radio station, WBGO, by calling us at 1-800-499-9246 or making a pledge online at wbgo.org. Portraits in Blue is up next on WBGO and wbgo.org.